26-point flight running late. I came in at 2. But the main reason was an uneasy conscience. Because I actually don't have terribly much to say about SZ. I was going to talk about a sort of crazy model of SZ from Supernova, but then I decided it might be a bit too crazy even for this audience. So I'm going to talk about, you know, that part of the cluster that you like to extract, you know, when you do SZ cosmology. So you can look at it as a little bit of light entertainment before the real cosmologists get down to work. And the work I'll talk about is mainly the work of my former student, Fu Lai, who's going to go to Santa Cruz for a postdoc, and one of the papers we also collaborated with Matthias Ruskowski. Okay, so cosmology, we really like the sort of standard objects, right, to calibrate what we're doing. We like the clusters to be these nice spherical cows. But unfortunately, they tend to be train wrecks. And, you know, Arif talked about the main train wreck, which I'm going to focus on in this talk, which is, you know, the beating heart at the center of the cluster. You know, it's pumping all this gas. And it's doing all these things which may or may not have interesting effects on the SZ signal. Certainly, they induce variations from cluster to cluster. Right, so AGN feedback, which is a sort of a very hot bandwagon right now, could do scary things to entropy and pressure profiles. And the main thing it would affect would be some, you know, what Arif mentioned in the cluster center. It would affect the SZ central decrement, and you know, it could do things to gas fractions, and also induce non-thermal pressure support. So in particular, you know, you always see these, you see in KUKO clusters, quite often you see bubbles, right? And these bubbles can excite turbulence, which can be, you know, a 10% effect in pressure support, 10 to 20%. And you could also have things like cosmic rays and magnetic fields being injected into the intracluster medium. Okay, so in this talk, I'm sort of going to step back and talk about two things. One would be cosmic ray heating, and just a sort of model for, you know, what cosmic rays could do in clusters. And this is a very sort of simple 1D model. And we had a very specific point, which is that things like Alphane wave heating could be important in clusters. If you want to see proper 3D cosmological simulations of cosmic rays in clusters, you should hang around for Christoph's talk. So I hope you will not beat me over with this stick. I'm holding on to it. So this is a very idealized situation, but I think at least it's a potentially important point. And the other issue I want to talk about was this dichotomy between KUKOR and non-KUKOR clusters, which Arif mentioned. You know, life would be much better and much simpler if clusters were just all non-KUKOR. And you know, if they didn't cool and they just behave nicely and adiabatically like they do in simulations when you turn off cooling. Unfortunately, you know, there's this sort of strange behavior, and I want to propose a possible explanation for this dichotomy, which of course has to do with AGN feedback. Okay, so first of all, cosmic ray heating. You know, you're all well aware that, you know, cooling times can be super short in clusters, and yet, you know, the clusters do not appear to cool, right? And you know, this of course was very startling when it first came out, you know, I guess about 9 years ago now. But you know, the way you get around this cooling catastrophe is just to say, well, you know, it's something's heating it, right? You don't complain about a cooling catastrophe at the center of the sun. So the analogy I want to draw here is that your AGN are your nuclear reactions, okay? And the center of the sun, you know, there's sort of very sensitive feedback mechanisms, right? If the core gets a little hotter, then the nuclear reactions speed up, and then you know the sun expands and becomes less dense and all of that. And I want to argue that perhaps you know similar mechanisms could happen at center clusters. Now this is a point that of course you know many people have made. I just want to make an argument that it could explain the difference between cool-core and non-cool-core clusters. So this is a very attractive solution because it would also explain the lack of cool gas at the center of clusters. Another big source of energy is possibly thermal conduction, right? And this you can sort of wave your hands around and say, well, okay, you know, we don't know what magnetic fields are doing, and you know, it's always a huge unknown, you know, what's the suppression below Spitzer, how is it as a function of radius? And I think perhaps the most relevant thing to note is that somehow clusters do know about Spitzer conduction. If you plot the level of conduction that's required to balance cooling, somehow clusters know that they should roughly be at some fraction of Spitzer, right? And it's just a remarkable conspiracy, I think, that just purely from observations, if you take temperature profiles, you know, you take the derivatives and so forth, somehow just the heat reservoir from outside the hot regions, if conducted inwards, could balance cooling. So it's by no means a physics argument, but it's a very striking observation. So potentially conduction can be very important. So you know what you can do is, you know, and what people have done is you can build models, for instance, with conduction only, and can balance cooling, and you're fine and dandy. The problem with such models is that they tend to be unstable. You have to tune parameters, and if you just start from arbitrary initial conditions, you won't settle to this final solution. You end up with a cooling catastrophe. If you tune your model so that you start out this way, then you can happily sit there for quite a long time. But it's very hard to sort of you know, survive, say, if you have a merger and things like that. So you know, there are many people here in the audience who have done many more detailed calculations of this. So I'm going to focus on you know, these train wrecks at the center. And the particular thing I want to focus on is what cosmic rays could do. So why cosmic rays? You know, we see radio synchrotron emission from the bubbles in X-ray, and so we know there's a relativistic population. And there are many sources that could give rise to this, you know, jets, accretion shocks, supernova. And the nice thing about cosmic rays is that, you know, they have long mean free paths and they can run around, right? And it's a potentially very promising way of coupling the energy from the bubbles into the gas. So, you know, obviously it's not a new idea. I'm sorry for this terrible color. Many people have worked on this. The problem before was that you could get cosmic rays to have a lot of dynamical effects. So if you pump in cosmic rays, they can easily, you know, dominate the pressure support, for instance. The problem is getting them to actually do something thermally. You know, in sort of previous models, you know, they have very interesting dynamical effects, but thermally they were sort of subdominant. And the key reason for this is that if cosmic rays just diffuse with some diffusion coefficient, which is comparable to that in the galaxy, or even if you allow order of magnitude swap one way or another, the transport timescales are extremely long. So what happens if you put this in a simulation is that you have an overpressured cluster center where you have a lot of dynamical things going on, but then nothing happens at the outskirts. And so the outskirts cool catastrophically and you still have a huge cooling flow. Now, this sort of you know, overpressured center could, in principle, drive turbulent convection. So there's some work on this. And that could have thermal effects. And this is something that Benjamin Chandra and his collaborators are working on. But if you don't have turbulent convection, then this is a difficult problem to solve. So in our model, what we did is we said, okay, diffusion doesn't work. Let's use the bubbles, right? We see the bubbles, let's use them. And the good thing about the bubbles is you know they contain non-thermal particles. But the transport time scale is the buoyancy time scale, which is of order sound crossing time, which is something like 10 to the 8 years. So that's much faster. So as these bubbles rise, they will be tend to be disrupted by various instabilities, you know, Kelvin-Helmholtz, Rayleigh-Taylor, and they'll shed the cosmic rays, and the cosmic rays can run around and heat the intercrustal medium. Okay, so so let's do this. So we did a very simple model. I should say that Christoph has a 3D cosmological model of this. The main thing that we tried to do was to put in Alphane wave heating. Okay, so you can put in a steady state cosmic ray spectrum and various energy loss mechanisms. And the most important energy loss mechanism we found was that if the cosmic rays stream outwards, you know, they'll excite Alphane waves, which will eventually nonlinearly land out there, and those could heat the intracrustal medium. So the trouble is that you don't know the rate at which bubbles disrupt, and therefore the rate at which the cosmic rays are injected into the intracrustal medium. So like you know, all good model builders, you know, you just put this unknown power law index. And I mean, it's the best you can do now. You know, obviously, the disruption rate is a fascinating first principles physics calculation, which, you know, that is sort of, I think, a very exciting problem, which, you know, people at CEDAR are trying to solve. We didn't try to do that. But what we tried to show is that it's not too sensitive to the spatial profile to disruption, right? Okay, so so you can do this, and if you do this, you'll essentially get a heating rate, and the luminosity of cosmic ray injection is proportional to the accretion rate onto the black hole. So you have a feedback mechanism in here. And then I'll just skip this. Now, there's also work done as the bubbles expand due to PdV work. So the bottom line is, if you start from arbitrary initial conditions, you can settle on to a profile which looks remarkably like observations with no cooling catastrophe, which is quite nice, actually. And for instance, if you try to do this with thermal conduction alone, it's very difficult to make it work. And various things check out, like the cosmic ray pressure is less than the thermal pressure, and good things like that.
Sorry, did you check that you don't overproduce the upper bound or the gamma ray machine clusters?
Yes. So we didn't directly do the calculation, but the energy density that we get in cosmic rays is less than where is it? It's well below 10%, or it's about 10%, and I think that's, you know, that is within the Ebert bounds.
I think within Ebert, yes, but if you then sort of go and look at the radio emission versus, for instance, then at least you have to do a little bit of funny stuff in the magnetic field to satisfy the radio emission, to basically sort of explain the radio emission, not overproduce the radio emission observed in these radio mini halos. But I think that that's still consistent.
I think it's as far as I know, it should be okay, but I think it's at the level where, you know, you could start to see something with blast. And yeah. Okay, so so the main thing that we liked about it is that there's no fine tuning in these models. You know, you can have a wide range of conduction suppression parameters. You can have a wide range of cosmic bubble disruption slopes, and it would all still work. So in that sense, it's very nice. You know, you don't violate conditions on, you know, pressure support by cosmic rays, things like that. And you know, potentially, you know, these sort of things are testable with glass. One thing that's sort of tangentially interesting is that, you know, in many optical filaments that you see in clusters, there needs to be some sort of anomalous heating. The electron temperature is too high for pure photoionization alone. And you can run cloudy models. People observe the electron temperature by looking at fine structure line ratios. And then if you run cloudy models, you can't get such high electron temperatures. So it's possible that, you know, cosmic rays are penetrating these filaments and providing extra heating, and that, you know, your filaments could actually be a very nice thermometer, or maybe more accurately, calorimeter of what's going on. Yes?
Yes, one problem with the filaments actually are pulled up by some magnetic flux tube. Then you actually have to consider the cross-field diffusivity, and this is by orders of magnitude smaller than the sort of diffusivity along the field line. So it's probably difficult for it to really penetrate, you know, light up the whole filament there that you see.
That's true, but the cosmic rays could be diffusing outwards as well, right? If they're injected at the center, they would tend to diffuse outwards along radial fuel lines. So, but I haven't done this calculation in detail, so yes.
There will be then some sort of alpha gradient along the filament, which I guess is not observed, because there is some time scale associated with transport.
That's true.
On a penny time scale, basically, and that means you can sort of see some sort of profile, but nothing profile.
This calculation needs to be done.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So, all right. So much for that. Hopefully, something that will be of more interest to this audience is, you know, the big picture, right? So not these cosmic rays rattling around, but you know, what makes some clusters cool core and some non-cool core. And I want to propose a picture based on stability of clusters. So Reed mentioned initial conditions, which is, you know, how much preheating you suffer. So we just wanted to look at how clusters vary in the stability based on, you know, the central temperature and central entropy. And so in particular, you know, issues of fine tuning. So for instance, you know, I mentioned that with conduction alone, you can build these very nice steady state models. The problem is that if you actually do that in simulations, you don't evolve to this state, you get a catastrophic cooling flow. And as a function of time, you see that the simulation evolves to this horrible thing instead of staying at the simulations, which is unlike the AGN model. So somehow, you know, models which have some kind of feedback, like AGN, are stable, whereas, you know, these models, which otherwise would be perfectly decent solutions, are unstable. You know, how can you solve this problem? So obviously, you know, what you can do is you can run a lot of simulations with all kinds of different parameters and see what's stable and what's not stable. But we want a tool that would be sort of quick and dirty, and let us try and tease apart the physics responsible for global stability. So, you know, you're all familiar with local stability analysis. You know, it's just WKB. You take the equations, you know, you perturb them, you get plane waves, you know, and then you get an eigenvalue problem. And then you just see if they're growing modes or not. The problem is that WKB is not valid in a cluster, right? Because essentially your cooling flow is a global mode, and it has length scales comparable to the size of a cluster. So you can't perturb around a background solution, right? So you have to actually solve the global eigenvalue problem, where you take the solutions and then you imply these all-important boundary conditions, and you actually find the eigenmodes. You solve a set of coupled differential equations, right? And you get a growth rate, which is an eigenvalue of this analysis. And okay, it sounds like a lot of theoretical hot air, right? So what? You get something which is less accurate than the simulations. Big deal. The good thing about something like this is that it enables you to explore parameter space extremely rapidly. You can play around with a whole bunch of things, you know, it runs in a second. And also, it helps you understand a little bit of the physics of what's going on. Yes.
So you assume adiabatic evolution here? Or?
No, so you have cooling, you have everything that you had in whatever the Zeus model that you did. So you just take the hydro Zeus models, then you set the time derivatives to zero, so you get a steady state background solution, and then you perturb that. And then you find the eigenmodes and the growing eigenfunctions. Yeah. And so, you know, for instance, here's the eigenfunction and temperature and perturbation in the radius. So what happens is that you have unstable modes when you have conduction only, but you find that they are suppressed once you have AGN in the system, right? And the crucial term actually does turn out to be this feedback term. So you can show that if you perturb the feedback term and you include it in the equations, the system is stabilized. Whereas if you do not include it, it is not stabilized. Okay, so this is something, it's nice to show, but it's not unexpected. Right, makes sense. And there's a critical, you know, level of feedback. I don't think I really want to bother with the numbers. But the interesting thing is that stability actually depends on the background profile. So this was something that we actually did not expect. So stability is actually sort of bimodal. You can get cuprochrome clusters which are stabilized primarily by the AGN, or non-cuprochrome stabilized primarily by conduction. But for intermediate temperatures, there is no stable solution. So for instance, here's the stability of solutions for fixed, say, conduction parameters and feedback efficiency as a function of the inner temperature, and here's a case when here's a case where you know, for low temperatures you have stability, and for high temperatures you have stability, but at intermediate temperature values, the growth time of the instability can be short. And although this unstable time scale is formally, you know, it's a few giga years, when you actually run a simulation, it can be shorter because the nonlinear effects start to build up. So this was something interesting and that we actually did not expect.
So how do we relate? So the reef was doing everything in terms of entropy.
Right.
So are these also lower different amounts of entropy?
Yeah, it's entropy in the sense that if you hold a density profile fixed and change the inner temperature, then you know that changes the entropy linearly too.
But in the stuff he was showing, there's stuff where the cooling time was very long, which would mean that.
Right. So the cooling time is very long in the, for instance, in the non-cuprochrome clusters. And so when I say you have to be stabilized for conduction, sometimes you don't need any stabilizing mechanism at all. The question is, you know, why are there so few clusters with intermediate temperatures? Why do they fall into this bimodal pattern? And it seems like you can be stabilized quite well at low temperatures, but intermediate temperatures, you're sort of in this never-never land between conduction and AGN.
But even without conduction, wouldn't you get something like this? So if the cooling time's long, it sits there.
No, but without conduction,
stored, it then starts falling in until the AGN turns on and stops.
Yes, but the question is, why don't you have a case with an intermediate temperature profile where the AGN is still stably, heating the gas at, say, 3 keV? You know, why is the central temperature either 1 keV or 5 keV? Okay, so this is more or less consistent with observations. In the sense that, you know, if you group things, then they mostly fall into this non-cuprochrome or cuprochrome dichotomies. And, you know, you see more AGN activity in systems with cuprochromes. And particular, for instance, this is the, oh my god, this is the cooling time, and you know, cavities are seen in systems with very short cooling times, whereas there's not much central activity in systems with longer cooling times. Okay, so and then more recently, you know, some people looked at you know, whether conduction was able to stabilize systems in cool core and non-cool core clusters, and generally they found that conduction would be sufficient in non-cool core systems, but in cool cores you needed something else. So it could be AGM feedback, it could be something else, but certainly conduction alone is not enough. Okay, so so you know, this is just sort of a sort of interesting idea. You know, there's sort of many follow-up questions. You know, obviously the best thing is to start is to do these things in proper 3D simulations. But you know, other things I just want to mention is, for instance, you know, almost all simulations assume Bondi accretion, and we know that Bondi accretion is, you know, probably quite a terrible approximation. I mean, there are very few systems where, you know, our galactic center is not Bondi accreting. You know, we hardly see any ellipticals where, you know, power is consistent with Bondi accretion. I mean, there is this amazing Allen et al. Result where, yes, where they observe temperature and density profiles, they extrapolate inwards, and they find amazingly good correlation between the Bondi profile, Bondi accretion rate you might infer, and the actual jet luminosity they infer from the abundance of cavities. I would say this is kind of a miracle, and it would be really great to understand this. It's just very difficult to imagine that, you know, there's things like, you know, angular momentum, you know, non-thermal effects, just thermal instabilities. There's all kinds of crazy things that could disrupt Bondi and that we know prevent Bondi accretion from happening in most ellipticals, and yet there's this sort of magical relation. I, for one, really would like to understand this better.
But the slope is at 1, right?
No, so the slope is slightly different from 1, but still the fact that there's such a strong correlation, I think, is very striking. And the errors are sufficiently large that the difference from 1 is not statistically significant, really.
So it's not hard to imagine that there are correlations.
But the fact that it's so tight, I guess, you know, I would have expected a lot more scatter. Where did it go?
I just passed it.
Where did
it go? Oops.
Keep going. All right. I think this is a miracle. I mean, the thing is, they measure, you know, density at, say, a kiloparsec, and then they extrapolate power law inwards up to, you know, the Bondi radius, which is at least an order of magnitude inwards. And if they were missing one data point, they would extrapolate a different power law, and, you know, it would break. Actually played with that, but it doesn't. So they just had the right amount of information. It's really a miracle. Okay, anyway, yeah, I'm sorry, this is kind of not really related to this conference. But anyway, I have this crazy thing I can talk about, but it's a bit embarrassing. So, okay, I mean, there are all these things about magnetic fields, and I'm sure at some other conference you'd like to hear about them. The main thing, I guess, is that, you know, clusters are complicated, and you know, we don't know for sure, you know, what effects are operating to sort of maintain the nice spherical clouds that they appear to be, so that scatter is not as big as you might fear. And so it's just nice to understand this a bit better. So that's it.
So we heard from the first talk by Eric that AGN heat feedback cannot work because the energy that's required for AGN to deposit is too large to be feasible.
Okay.
But why can you address that?
So okay, so so certainly once you are in a cool core state, right, it's you just have to balance the X-ray luminosity. Right, so you know, that's about 10 to the 44 Earths per second, perhaps. And AGN certainly have enough energy to do that.
But
so
that you need 10 to the 48.
Right, so what he said was that suppose you want to transform a cool core to a non-cool core, then you need to lift up a cold gas to large radii, and the binding energy involved can be, say, 10 to the 63 Earths, which is quite large. Right, so that argues for nature rather than nurture. So it's initial conditions. So so this is actually something that we're looking at right now, and I actually think it might be possible to transform a cool core to a non-cool core. You know, that argument assumes that all the energy comes from the AGN alone. But really, all you care about is the central region. So if you say, let me take all the energy, say, within the cooling radius, or a fair fraction of the cooling radius, and I want to heat that up, yes, that is a lot of energy. But really, what you want to affect is the coldest gas at the center, because that's not susceptible to conduction, really. You know, the temperature's low. We know that AGN have highly variable power spikes. If you inject a fairly large power spike, so for instance, we see events like Hydra, right? So Hydra actually does inject, you know, of order 10 to the 62, 10 to the 63.
It gets it up to entropy of 30.
But, you know, what happens is that it's not all just the AGN. So what it does is that the AGN changes the temperature profile, and it allows conduction to operate more efficiently. So if you put them both together in a simulation, so this is still preliminary, so I will not, you know, vouch for this, but at least in what we've seen so far, you can actually transform a non-cool core, a cool core to a non-cool core from a large energy spike. And a lot of the energy comes from increased conduction as you change the temperature profile.
I just want to point out there are actually subtle effects involving magnetic fields here that actually might help solving this problem tremendously. You know, you are forced actually to sort of make these bubbles stable, because in a pure hydro model, these bubbles just rock on one rising time, and you don't see this. You see them sort of consistent up there. So one simple solution to this problem is if you just compute the right physics in a magnetized medium, then you actually have a magnetic draping effect that conserves these bubbles, keeps them stable, and actually what it implies, it sort of releases the amount of cosmic rays, assuming that there are cosmic rays in these bubbles, on some given time scale. That means, you know, just enough to heat the surrounding, and that, you know, that means you have a transport mechanism that sort of transports the cosmic rays on a fast rate and just releases the sort of right amount to sort of, or might release the right amount to sort of balance the cooling. So that way, that would be one way out, sort of say. And this has to be looked at in detail. I mean, that's
right.
Really...
But there is a challenge you can think of, because he's trying to release the cosmic rays by disrupting the bubbles. It's a bubble disruption that's releasing, whereas draping is going to prevent that.
Yeah,
but there's some, you know,
it release the actual cosmic rays down there, so it prevents it in the upper part. But if you look at the 3D simulation, then you see actually that there are magnetic flux tubes coming out that in fact actually conduct cosmic rays on a quite high rate actually down there. I mean, this was work done by Matthew Ruskowski, and that seemed to be quite promising, that you have physical model that's quite naturally coming out that might provide some sort of boundary or some sort of background solution to this problem. But I completely agree, this is at this point completely speculative, and needs to be worked
out. Oh, I agree. Yeah, that'd be very interesting to work it out.
So, for instance, you know, AGN activity, although it may not inject enough energy, could change the topology of magnetic field lines itself. So, you know, the rising bubbles can cause the field lines to be more really radially oriented, and you know, decrease your conduction suppression. And there's a huge heat reservoir in the outer regions that has more than enough energy there to convert it to a non-cooled form.
There's excess entropy at out to 300 kiloparsecs.
But if you drain a little bit of energy from the outer regions, it has very little effect on the entropy because the amount of energy in the outer regions
is so
much
larger. No, what I mean is that there's excess energy above gravitational heating at 300 kiloparsecs.
That's true, but
so
you know,
that
it
means
would be
that you need to either heat that gas up at 300 kiloparsecs in addition to heating the core up.
I mean, there's no doubt there's probably preheating taking place. The question is, you know, whether you can convert a cool core to a non-cool core, you know, after the fact. And I would argue that it might be possible.
Right.
I
think it'd be interesting to work it out. No.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Okay.
But in terms of the scenario of the Lovich effect.
What?
So that was this slide. That was the slide where I had my general hand waving thing. Yes. Oops. Yes. They could affect everything which affects the Sunyaev-Seldovich effect.
Right, but at what level would you expect? So the SD effect is much, you know, it's pressure, integrated pressure, and, you know, if it's in some kind of equilibrium, can you really screw around with the pressure profile a lot?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you can screw around with the entropy profiles to the extent of converting a non-cool core to a cool core to a non-cool core, then as you saw previously, you know, that had a significant difference in, you know, SEY and central decrement. Right, so if there's some sort of cycling effect taking place,
well, what you need to change is the thermal pressure profile, or the integrated thermal pressure.
That's right. By the way,
so
what
Rich was doing, it didn't change the thermal pressure profile very much when you integrated it, except for, you know, low masses for groups and things like that.
Yes, but if you change the central entropy, I thought the central temperature decrement changed at the sort of 10% level.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, it's basically degenerate with this, you know, however much, you know, the profiles change as you change the entropy, you know, the central entropy. Now, that's the difference between the cool core and the non-cool core. If you can achieve this with AGN, then it would have the same effect. I mean, I think that certainly some amount of preheating has to be taking place. It's just that, you know, it does seem like it's fairly close. You know, it's about, you know, sort of 50-50 cool core, non-cool core, 30-70. You know, why isn't it, you know, if it's a result of initial conditions, why is it so close? You know, it seems a bit odd. Also, for instance, non-cool core clusters have a fairly flat metallicity profile, whereas cool cores have fairly steep metallicity profile. And that's something that's very easy to understand if it's a result of energy injection, you know, within the cluster itself. If it's a result of initial conditions, it's a little bit harder to understand.
So I have a question. So the difference between the energy of cool core and non-cool core, what fraction of the real energy of the cluster is it? The thermal.
It is, well, I guess the fraction of thermal energy within the cooling radius, which is, what's a good number?
Okay.
Tens of percent, yeah.
Tens of percent.
10%, yeah.
So that would say that the SDY decrement, that's going to change by 10%.
The total Y, or do you mean the sort of central constant Y?
No, the total Y within the
total Y is basically coming from regions that are at half R200 because of the sort of temperature pressure profile.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very difficult to sort of change something there. That's where the total Y is dominated. I mean, this is why it's still a very good thermometer of a galaxy cluster. If you can't get out to R there, then you might all sort of see this sort of subtle biases that sort of all mess up the central parts. You know, because, and that's what we see in simulations as well,
if the central compute body is sensitive to all sorts of sort of feedback processes. But you know, the more you integrate out, the less of an effect it has, because more difficult it gets, especially for large clusters, to sort of make something work.
But the question is it within the virial radius, is it a 10% effect or a 1% effect?
So I mean, it's more of a, if you say you sort of put yourself onto the radiative, if you say I already sort of think that I more or less understand my radiative physics, which is not true currently, but it is, because then I think from there it's more of a few percent, up to at most 10% level. But yeah, that's sort of.
I mean, people also argue about, you know, whether EGN, say, from ellipticals escaping to the intergalactic medium, whether the preheating itself can have a significant SE signal. And I think most of the consensus is that it's probably small. Although, I'm not sure some people here have done calculations of that.
But isn't that mainly, don't you get a bigger signal from the kinetic effects of just the big influence?
Well, it depends on, I mean, certainly that's true for, say, reionization. I think if you have sort of EGN heating at redshift 2, the temperatures can be quite large, and there can be a decent thermal effect. But I think, like, Evan Scannon-Kiefer has done some work on this. The trick is, you know, at that point, you have to be careful not to evade quantum Y balance.
Okay, great. So let's thank Tang again.